men in the malls. I love the factories, I love the rubber balls. I love the ukuleles and the sound of spinning tape. I love the things that people make. I love the tricycles, I love the synagogues. I love the Lego and I love the Lincoln Logs. I love the fishing lures, I love the plumber's snakes. I love the things that people make. Knives, I love the God knows. I love the way that people decorate their homes. I love the ovens and the casseroles they make. I love the things that people make.
Good morning, you are listening to These Things That People Make. Today's show is an interview with the fabulous Mary Breen, who is the owner of Wise Daughters, a craft market and workshop space in Toronto. It's located at 3079 Dundas Street West. And if you want to check out the website while you're listening to the interview, you can go to wisedaughters.com. Mary's story of opening this shop is really incredible. She has a lot of really amazing things, and also ongoing is hosting a variety of really neat workshops. So listen to this interview and hear the story of the store.
I opened it in January 2009, and I had worked in the nonprofit sector for 22 years at that point. And I'd been laid off for the fifth time because I had an erring ability to take a job immediately before a change in government that would result in the defunding of that particular job. So the last one, it was quite remarkable. I took a job as ED of a labor museum when the NDP was in power in Ontario, and they said, here's a building, it lost the election, and it was like, good luck, with no money. So I'd had a number of challenges like that. I was executive director of Kensington Youth Theatre and Employment Skills at the tail end of the Mike Harris years, if you can imagine anything worse. And it didn't survive, which pretty much broke my heart. And at that point, actually, that was around when I turned 40, I went and worked for a small business by accident. I had taken up Pilates at the time for my health, and I just wanted to barter for my Pilates classes. And the woman who ran the studio said, what do you know how to do? And I said, run stuff. And she said, okay, manage the studio. So that's how I ended up learning about small business.
Yeah,
I managed the studio. And running a small business is so much easier than being executive director of anything. I thought, well, I could do this. So that's when the germ of a small business was planted. But then I was lured back to the nonprofit sector by the Women's Future Fund, which was such a good model. It was this national organization to fundraise on behalf of all the other national women's organizations so they wouldn't have to each do it themselves and go after the same funders and mm-hmm. compete with each other and just pool it, right? So it was a really sensible model, but it was still fairly new, and the federal government had committed to 5 more years of funding through Status of Women Canada, and I thought, well, those are pretty good odds. And then, of course, Harper got in and dismantled Status of Women Canada, so I lost that job, and then I thought, okay, now I'm done. Now I'm really done. And so I decided to start a small business, and I didn't even know what kind. And I got together a whole bunch of women in a sort of focus group with really no preconceived ideas about what I might do, but just asking them what doesn't exist that should exist, a product or a service or anything really. And what came out of that was a few things. Place to hang out, like a community place to hang out that's a little different than what already exists, like not a bar, not a coffee shop, but not a library either, like something in between. And a place to be creative, but everybody's really, really pressed for time. So not a 12-week course, but just like come, everything's supplied, be creative, make something fabulous, go home. So I started mulling on that. And then I got a really attractive contract to archive the second wave of feminism in Canada, because everybody's getting older. So the people who are activists in the 60s and 70s were getting a lot older, and a lot of them were not paying attention to what was happening with their records, and the records of a whole bunch of organizations that had long since become defunct were disappearing. So this was a really good idea that Senator Nancy Ruth funded, partly because she had just gone through the process of sending a whole bunch of her own records to the archives and thought, everybody my age should be doing this. So I got that contract that I thought would be a few months, and it turned into a little over a year. So during that time, I was still kind of mulling over what this business idea might be. And when my contract with Nancy Ruth ended, I started kind of accidentally baking. Well, I really like baking. And I started baking for a local cafe, and I thought, maybe I'll open a bake shop.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I had in mind. Cafe, mostly bake shop. And I started hunting for places. And then, this sounds like a really strange business plan, because it wasn't like, oh, I wrote a business plan for a craft shop and then I opened one. It was so not like that. The space that I have at Quebec and Dundas, I would pass by every day, because I just lived down the street at Quebec and Annette at the time. And it was such a beautiful space, and it just kind of called to me. And then I started thinking, what could I do in this space?
Yeah.
And Crema had just opened next door and had perfect coffee. So I thought, well, I don't need to make perfect coffee. That's already been achieved right here on this corner. But maybe there needs to be a bake shop. And that was a pretty smart idea, bake shop, because now there's a bake shop in the Junction that's hugely successful. There was a need for a bake shop that I identified. But the landlord didn't really want that. They didn't really want food in there. And I just kept visiting the space and then not taking it. And they were looking for the perfect tenant. And meanwhile, at Reba's Cafe, where I was baking, I organized a craft show. I forget why. It just seemed like a good idea. I got together some women I knew who made interesting things, and I organized a craft show. And I sold my baking. And then I thought, maybe this is what I need to do. This is the way I can have workshops about all kinds of things, and the retail piece can be handmade goods, not baked goods. So I went back to the landlords and said, okay, now I think maybe I want to do this. And they said, that's a fantastic idea. And gave me quite a good deal because I'm off Dundas there, not quite on the main drag. So I really quickly, like from December, the beginning of December to the end of January, sort of reshaped my entire business plan and collected 25 local artisans. Some I knew, or, you know, it was sort of word of mouth, and some, like, I just went around to every little craft show and curated, picked stuff I liked. I'd worked in a museum before, so I sort of felt like I had some aesthetic sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked stuff. And when I opened, I had the idea that it would be much more evenly split between fine art, sort of gallery, and craft. But it turned out that was not what the Junction Market wanted or needed or could bear. So I started shifting away from fine art. I show emerging artists, student artists, you know, very new artists, basically, whose work is affordable. But established artists, no, it's not that kind of gallery. It just, that wasn't what the community needed. So now I have 75 artisans, and I have not sought a single one. The tripling has just been people approaching me, and mostly from the neighborhood, and a little further afield, Toronto and some parts of Southern Ontario, but it's been really amazing how organically it's come together, actually, because I've met all these people in the neighborhood who make beautiful things, and they might never have sold in a shop before, or, you know, they might have done a couple of little shows or whatever. And I'm getting a lot better after 2.5 years at choosing what I think my market wants and understanding even if it's not my taste is the right thing for the shop and all of that. And so the retail piece continues to be secondary in my head to the workshop piece, which is what I always wanted to do, have a place where people could come and make things. And that part has been building very nicely, but the retail is still by far a bigger income generator, and, you know, I guess that's how it will be for some time.
Hello, this is These Things That People Make. Today's show, we are airing an interview with Mary Breen, the owner and operator of Wise Daughters. It's a craft market and workshop space in Toronto. We return now to that interview.
Can you give us a few examples of some of the things that you sell in your store for people who haven't been there?
Sure. Well, I have quite a few jewelry designers, but I'm very careful not to let jewelry take over. So I keep it to a very small proportion overall what's in the shop. I have home decor stuff, but as I was saying, it's not so much fine art as maybe limited edition prints that are more affordable, textile art, mosaic, some glass, pottery, mostly made by women at Inspiration Studio, which is a program of sistering. So they're women who've experienced homelessness or poverty or trauma and are learning small business skills and ceramic skills and life skills at the same time. And I have an arrangement with them where they receive 75% of the proceeds directly. I have some adorable baby stuff. And some handmade toys, lots of accessories, handmade bags and scarves and hats and stuff like that, lots of cards and paper things, beautiful notebooks and journals, some quirky stuff like felt trophy heads.
I love
for
those
you
felt
all.
Trophy
I enjoy
heads.
Those very much. There's a fair bit of humor in some of the stuff I stock.
Yeah.
I have politician finger puppets. I enjoy them.
You do?
I do.
I missed those.
I have all the federal leaders.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I had all the mayoral candidates in the fall. Yeah, so that's kind of generally what I have. And then I do have rotating exhibits downstairs in the workshop space. But now I feature like group shows or emerging artists and the next show that I'm actually very excited about is the exhibit version of Elizabeth Fraser's project, A Year from Scratch, where she made something from scratch once a week for a year. And the thing she made, she pulled out of a hat of suggestions people had sent her. And whatever it was, that's what she made. So some of it were sort of science projects, some of it was food, and some of it was craft. And she's going to highlight about a dozen of the projects, some of them disastrous, some of them hugely successful. I think it'll be really fun.
When is that opening?
July 8th. And it runs all summer and into September.
Yeah. That's a great idea. That should be a book.
It will be a book.
It could have been a calendar. It could be a calendar.
It's going to be both those things.
Whoa.
She blogged. She made something and blogged about it every week. And every blog contained instructions to make whatever it was. So you could do it yourself. And she is going to turn it into a book by the end of this year, she hopes. And a calendar.
Exactly. Cool. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back to something you said because I've worked in the nonprofit sector as well. And I also struggle with it as a model. Mm-hmm. And I just want to hear you talk a bit about, like, why is a small business easier to run than a nonprofit for you?
Because it's a benevolent dictatorship. I don't have a board. I'm accountable to nobody. I can make decisions instantly.
Yeah.
It's fantastic that way. I enjoyed working collaboratively. I've been in collectives. I always worked for boards. I was often executive director of organizations, so I was at least nominally the boss. But there's always, in a good organization, and they were mostly really good, a very collective kind of atmosphere. And that's beautiful, but now that I'm nearly 50, I kind of just want to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
Quickly, my way.
But I think also what you were talking about also is that, like, political climates really affect funding and possibilities.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, even super well-intending boards often try to reinvent ideas that have already been tried out. But, yeah.
It was more the funding losses that broke my spirit.
Yeah.
It was really hard. There were some really fantastic things that I was doing, particularly Kites, Kensington Youth Theater and Employment Skills, that was helping youth in the shelter system get back on their feet, get some high school credits, use theater as this really amazing tool to build back some self-esteem and take risks in a healthy way.
Yeah.
It was such an amazing program, and nobody would fund it at the point that I was there because the province considered it a social service and they were just not interested in social services at all at that time. And the feds considered it education and they wouldn't fund education. So nobody wanted to fund it. And I got to that job.
And no arts funding either.
Oh, a little bit. Yeah. Like bits of arts council funding and stuff like that, but not enough.
Because it wasn't full on, like, fine
art. It wasn't full time art either. It was like a hybrid of all these things.
Yeah.
So instead of everybody funding it, kind of nobody wanted to fund it. And it had always been difficult, but when I got there, it was really difficult. And there was 2 weeks worth of funding. When I arrived in the bank. And like 25 youth starting that week, the same day I started, actually. And I kept it going for a year and a half, which was pretty amazing. But ultimately, it just wasn't sustainable. And, you know, and then gang violence. There was the summer of the gun in Toronto when everybody was wringing their hands about gang violence. Oh, whatever could we do about this? No, nobody knows what to do about this. Like, we were doing something about this very effectively.
Yeah.
But not churning out 500, you know, drug-free, non-violent kids a year.
Yeah.
Like, maybe 30.
Yeah.
Because it's really hard to do.
Yeah.
So,
you've been listening to These Things That People Make. My name is Sarah Mangle. This is the third part of the show about Wise Daughters Craft Market. We return now to that interview.
And what about the workshops? What are workshops you've had in the past and what are upcoming workshops that you're doing?
Well, they're primarily crafty, and there is quite a demand for classic crafts. Everybody wants to learn to knit and crochet.
Yeah.
And embroider and stuff like that. So I want to meet that demand because that's great. And a lot of it has a really fun new twist. And young people want to do it and kids want to do it. But I often invite the artists whose work is in my shop to teach what they do, if that works. And I have a suggestion board in the workshop area where people write what they want to do. So when I see a suggestion enough times, I really try and find someone who can teach that. And, you know, often it happens that a whole bunch of people are desperate to learn something. I find the instructor And then nobody signed up for the class. That happened with traditional rug cooking. It was like, oh, yay, finally, I went to a guild. I found a traditional rug cooker. Oh, fantastic. Yeah, nobody signed up for the class. So, you know, there's no pleasing people, really. But I try. So we've had book binding a number of times, felting a number of times, because people love the trophy heads, and I have the best teacher in the world. And then I like to expand into other things, too. So we've had hand drumming recently. We've had clowning and creative writing and songwriting and improv and poetry. So I hope people will start to think of Wise Daughters as a place to
do a lot of different things.
Try a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I do get a lot of repeat customers at the workshops because crafters like to try a lot of things.
Yeah.
So somebody who has a good time at one workshop will come to another one just because it'll be fun, you know. So, yeah, most recently we did silk screening. That was wildly popular, and we had to add a second class. And I did it myself, and now I'm so smitten, I'm planning to spend the whole summer silk screening.
That's cool. I'm a silk screener, too.
Oh, it's so
I really enjoy it.
So
Yeah, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And so upcoming workshops, like in the near future?
The summer winds down.
Yeah.
I don't really have anything for adults on the schedule now until September because it's just too hit and miss with people away. I have craft camps for kids, half-day camps, and a knitting camp in August for kids. Yeah, I don't do kids programming throughout
the
year.
That's a cool idea, a knitting camp.
So fun. Yeah. I did a one-day workshop during March break, and that went well, so I thought I'd try a week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's about the kids for the summer, and then the rest of the year is not.
So are there any events that are coming up in the near future that you want to tell me about?
On Sunday, June 12th, in the afternoon, I'm hosting my second annual Worldwide Knit in Public Day. Worldwide Knit in Public Day is international. It was started in England in about 2004 or 2005. And last year, I had an event in Junction Square, which is an open space. It's a parking lot, actually. And we tried to beat the Guinness World Record for most knitters at one time.
What is the record?
Well, the world record at that time, when we submitted the thing, was below 1,000. So we thought, well, you know, maybe we can do that. Then a whole bunch of people beat the record, like, that very week, because people are starting to be aware of Worldwide Knit in Public Day, and ours was rained out, and we had to move it to the next day. So we didn't come anywhere near beating the record, but we still had about 200 knitters come out, and it was so much fun. Just people sitting on their lawn chairs knitting, everybody, like, every age, a whole bunch of people who didn't know how to knit, and we taught them on site, and it was really fun. So that led me to my Junction Arts Festival project of last September, which was to knit a cozy for a car. And
cool.
We did. I got the car from AutoShare. Well, it was a cube van, actually, so it was kind of large.
It's very large.
Well, not a cube van, like, for moving, but, you know, those new funny cube cars? They're called cubes. We did this for street knit, so people came out and could knit a few rows or a square. Fortunately, a lot of people knit squares ahead, so we were quickly crocheting them together all weekend.
Yeah.
And right at the end of the festival, at like 5 to 6 on the Sunday, we finished it. We covered the whole car. And it continues to be turned into blankets for street knit. So we took it apart because it was kind of hastily put together. And it's turning into blankets, you know, organized in a logical fashion. So all the wool squares are together and all the cotton squares are together and stuff. And people were very engaged with that. And it was fun that the road was closed so we could sit on the street and knit.
Yeah.
So this year, it's a little bit more modest. I couldn't get that public space, and I have to do it with no money whatsoever. But I did the car cozy with no money, too. So it's just a party. It's just to celebrate crafting in public.
And that does it for these things that people make today. For more information on Wise Daughters Craft Shop, go to www.wisedaughters.com and be sure to check out my blog, thesethingsthatpeoplemake.blogspot.com.
A simple dog with ears and nose. Eli, Eli, Eli. I don't know why nobody likes him. There's some people trying to put him away. When he comes up to them, they always say, go away, go away, please take him home, make him stay. Eli, 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 Eli. Several times I've tried to tell him, please don't make them say that. But he won't listen to me. Sometimes I pray that there could be more between us. But some people never are satisfied. Eli, Eli.